thank you for allowing us a summer setting. We always enjoy getting together in the summer. Our only argument on this panel this morning is State of Wyoming versus Dinky, and I see counsel are ready. We're ready to hear from the appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Mergen, and I'm here on behalf of the United States Department of the Interior. My intention this morning is to split my time evenly with counsel for the appellant interveners, the environmental NGOs, and hopefully reserve a little of my time for rebuttal. So I'm going to probably talk for 10 or 12 minutes and try to save three with the Court's indulgence. Thank you very much. I want to do three things this morning. I want to talk briefly about the history of the rule and where we are today. I want to talk about our submission, our request for relief here, which is that the Court hold the matter in abeyance, and also touch upon the merits and how the merits specifically relate to the relief that we request this morning. As the Court is aware, in 2015, a hydrofracking rule was promulgated. That rule did a couple of things. It addressed wellbore integrity. It intended to protect groundwater. It required disclosure of certain chemicals used, subject to proprietary controls by hydrofracking, and also disclosure of where hydrofracking water was coming from. The rule was published in March of 2015, and there was immediately a lawsuit challenging it. The scope of that lawsuit, as your honors are aware, was sort of twofold. One went to the authority of the agency to promulgate the rule, and the other was sort of your more traditional Administrative Procedure Act, arbitrary and capricious challenge to the rule's promulgation, the procedural regularities, et cetera. The rule was immediately enjoined. The United States filed an appeal of the preliminary injunction, and we filed an appeal of the merits. Subsequently, there was a change in administration. Notably, in January of 2017, the President issued Executive Order 13771, intended to lessen the regulatory burdens imposed on various entities throughout the U.S. In relation to that executive order, the Department of Interior started looking at its rulemaking docket. And in March of 17, the President issued an executive order directed towards energy independence, where the President specifically directed the Department of Interior to look at rescinding, revising, or suspending this rule. Now, consistent with that request, the Department of Interior began looking and, as of Tuesday, published a notice of proposed rulemaking to rescind this rule.
And what's the time frame for that? How does that?
Very important question, I realize, Your Honor. So the comment period is slated to close September 25th, 60 days for comment. The rule is published on Tuesday. That comment period could be extended.
Was it for the present rule? The present rule took 5 years to come to fruition, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
How will this be different?
What's that?
How will this rule be different?
I think in a couple of ways we can expect it to move more quickly. But regrettably, I wish I could tell you exactly when this process was going to be complete. But it will depend on the comments that are received and the agency's ability to process those comments. Now, I suspect that this rule will move more expeditiously than the 2015 rule because the rulemakers now have the benefit of that record. They have the benefit of that review. And that ought to provide, in theory, a basis for a more expedited rulemaking.
But all of those comments dealt with a rule that now is being changed. So how would they be even relevant?
Well, I think that the fact that they're familiar with the kinds of concerns that have been raised previously, had to grapple with those concerns, will necessarily inform this rulemaking. I think it has to, in a way, right?
How can you proceed with rulemaking when the district court told you you have no authority?
Well, Your Honor, we have a. I think that relates to the, you know, somewhat candidly awkward position I find the government finds itself in before you today, mm-hmm. right? Which is that if the district court had set aside, as the APA Section 704 talks about, set aside the rule on sort of procedural irregularities or the sort of more familiar arbitrary and capricious findings, then maybe the government would be in a position to dismiss its appeal. But the issue of authority has consequences may have consequences beyond this case. And that's what counseled the government to propose this somewhat unusual, although not unprecedented, approach to this court, which is to ask this court to hold the case in abeyance pending completion of this rulemaking. And I realize that that undoubtedly is a heavy lift, and I'm prepared to discuss that in some detail.
It is a heavy lift, particularly when, even if it's not 5 years and it's an expedited period, it's an indefinite period right now, and it's an indefinite period within your control. You know, when I look at American Petroleum, which is probably the closest analogy to this case, in that case, there was a fixed period that the court could point to, which would be around 17 months. That was it. And that played into its determination to stay the matter. That we don't have here. And I'm a little concerned about the notion or the precedent that we would be setting in allowing the executive branch to sort of jerk around our docket and tell us that to hold something in abeyance for what could be forever.
I'm very sensitive to that concern, Your Honor, and I have a couple of answers. One is that we don't expect to, my client does not expect to go off into a dark corner without this court's supervision. We would propose as an API that if the court were inclined to grant the relief that we ask, we would submit frequent status reports, maybe on the 90-day
mark. What's your incentive? What's the administration's incentive to act promptly if it's already gotten the relief it would get through changing the regulation by simply the abatement of this case?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things, Your Honor. First off, right, the president has directed them to do this, and I think the president didn't direct them to do nothing. He quite clearly in the executive order directed them to suspend, revise, or rescind. There were only four rules identified in that executive order for this kind of these next steps, and the president has made this a priority. Immediately following the president's executive order, the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, issued a secretarial order, and he directed the agency to proceed expeditiously.
But in that listing of rules to be reviewed expeditiously, there was a long laundry list. The BLM has a lot on its plate.
I cannot dispute that, Your Honor. It does. But with regard to rules, that executive order covered a lot of rules, like the Clean Power Plan, that are not in BLM's purview. So the rules that were in BLM's purview are not insignificant, but it is in no way the entire scope of that executive order. I mean, I realize, and I want to, Judge Holmes, you made an excellent point about API and the settlement that Judge Sentelle notes kept the agency on a some sort of a timeline of a year, right? I mean, from the time that the case was decided, I think the 17 months makes sense to me. I know it was a year from the case. The case was decided in December of 1 year, and they were intended to deliver the rule a year later. And, you know, I think the process envisioned in the API of status reports allows this court to judge for itself whether the agency is proceeding expeditiously. The agency can tell you what it's doing, how many comments it's received, its plan for dealing with those comments. And I certainly understand that this is a heavy lift. I don't want to take away from that.
And I appreciate your candor in that regard, but this just historically doesn't seem to be the role of the judiciary. I mean, you talk about oversight and monitoring. I mean, that's not – I didn't know that was my job description. And to that point, we have precedent that would suggest that if anything's appropriate in this situation, it would be a dismissal, not a stay. And as you again candidly pointed to at least two of the cases, and there are more, that suggest that if we're going to listen to you and say that at some level this is either prudentially unripe or prudentially moot, to use the other construct, that the answer that would follow from that is dismissal.
I mean, Your Honor, I recognize that there's force to that approach, for sure. And I would say that a dismissal, I think, as my colleagues from the NGOs have made would be more or less dependent on vacatur of the lower court decision. I mean, the bind that we find ourselves in is this case goes to authority. And I think, you know, I understand, I think, you
and
know,
isn't that, and isn't that issue ripe? And don't we have a duty to hear and decide?
I think that is the fundamental question before the court, for sure. And here is my submission with regard to that. The rule is final agency action. You can review it now. There is absolutely no bar to your reviewing the rule at this juncture. The arguments that the United States are making are prudential and pragmatic arguments to request that you hold the case in abeyance under your supervision with consistency.
Well, there's really two issues, aren't there? It's the authority of the BLM. That's the big issue.
Right.
That's the global issue. Then whether or not the BLM had authority to promulgate this specific rule is within that.
Yeah.
So I would think you would still be concerned with the global rule. That is the district court saying you have no authority.
Yeah, and I respectfully, of course, Your Honor, my client is concerned about that. And let me say a couple things about finality, because I want to be clear, it is final. But, you know, I think that Judge Santel's analysis in API is somewhat helpful, which is, you know, consistent with our view on the authority, the global authority, and the specific authority here. It is our submission that we have that authority. We think that history supports it. We think that the language of the four relevant statutory regimes support it. But, you know, one aspect of consistent with our argument that we have the authority and fundamental to our overall understanding of administrative law is that if we have the authority to interpret these statutes in one way, then a new administration can permissibly, subject to the court's review, or reasonably interpret those authorities in a different way for a different result. And one thing that Judge Santel says in API...
Shouldn't we proceed to determine if you have the authority? Isn't that main issue on the table for decision?
I mean, as I said, you could reach the issue. I think that our submission is that it is better to have... My point that Judge Santel also makes is consistent with our understanding that this is a Chevron 2 issue, that we have delegated authority, and this is a reasonable construction of our authority. That's the position we stake out in our merits brief. Consistent with that is the notion that if the administration decides to go in a different way, then, and through this, you know, laudatory process of seeking comments, seeking the participation of the public to inform a different direction, isn't there something to be said for waiting until that process is complete before entering into something as so fundamental and dispositive as the authority issue? Now, my colleagues say, and they make this point quite strongly, that the problem with what the United States is proposing is that there's this uncertainty about authority in the interim, and that will somehow cabin or constrain BLM's management. And I think the answer to that is there's really no doubt about what our position about the authority is. We've told you what our position is quite clearly here. We think that we had the authority to promulgate this rule. Whatever BLM does in response to the executive order, in response to Secretary Zinke's secretarial order, is necessarily going to be informed by the positions that we have taken before this court. And so, you know, I understand that this is a very heavy lift, but I want to say if you look at this court in particular, for its geographical reasons amongst others, has had to grapple with many of the thorniest natural resources issues out there. And I'm thinking of issues like the roadless rule, Yellowstone snowmobiles, the management of the Rio Grande system with regard to the Silvery Minnow and those issues. And in all of those cases, there have been times where this court has relied on a justiciability doctrine to say, not yet, not at this time. So, you know, in 2005, this court...
Let me ask.
Yeah. That's all right.
If the final rule that's promulgated is like what was proposed earlier this week, as I understand, which was just abrogating
Yes.
The most recent rule, the rule that's up before us. Does that moot the authority issue?
I don't think it moots the authority issue, and I don't think I can say that it moots the authority issue.
How does it not moot the authority? If the decision of the agency is to not exercise authority,
yeah,
then why would you need to decide whether the agency had authority?
Well, Your Honor, the proposal that was published on Tuesday is just that, a proposed rule.
No, I realize that.
And I can't.
I'm asking if the final rule is what is proposed in the proposed rule, does that not moot the issue of authority?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. It is absolutely our submission that a final rule promulgated as a result of this process that the Interior Department has initiated will moot out this case.
But it won't moot out the authority issue, right? Because the authority issue relates to your ability to regulate fracking and or fracturing, and the prior rule does that too. It just does it in a different way, right?
Yeah, Your Honor, of course, you're absolutely correct. But I think that what the result, let's say hypothetically, because I cannot prejudge their process,
sure,
right? They could do a number of things. But let's say hypothetically what they do is they publish a final rule that doesn't look that much different from this rescinded rule. Our submission is the authority day lives. We agree with the environmental groups that the proper course at that time is to vacate the district court's decision, at which point the authority issue remains to be resolved at another day. And I think important to our submission to the court today is that it may never need to be resolved, right? Our as you know from our briefs, our view is that we have been regulating in ways like this for nearly 100 years. That we think the district court didn't apprehend that. But all those other regulatory schemes, some of which are quite similar to what is at the table here, industry didn't have a problem with. So
that's because they didn't have a problem with the substance of it. I mean, it seems to me teasing out something that Judge Briscoe is making. In American Petroleum, one of the things that made it unright was the variation in the substance. Nobody was talking about the authority, and so one could divide those and view those as discrete issues. And the substance here is this rolling thing that's going on, but we've got a fixed thing, this issue of whether you have authority or not. Why is that not ripe apart from the substance of it?
If this case goes away because a final rule moots this out, then the authority issue will live or die in the context of a specific case or controversy. If on a new rule the industry doesn't like the new rule, or they think that they should just take on the authority up front, then that issue will come back to a court for resolution. And that's
What do you do with Munsingware? I mean, the old rule where if you want a vacation or vacatur of a district court rule, you can't be the party that makes it moot. And you're the party that's making it moot.
Again, Your Honor.
So you win-win. You get to do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it. No, I'm serious.
No,
this is the way this looks.
Yeah, I understand that, Your Honor. I think what we have been careful to say in our briefs, mindful of that concern, is that our co-appellants, intervener appellants, are entitled to the Munsingware relief. And that has how this issue...
So they would be entitled to vacation of the district court order?
Mm-hmm. And that's how this issue has played out in cases like Silvery Minnow, in cases like the Roadless Rule. Mm-hmm. So I take your point, Your Honor. We have struggled to propose to this court a way forward that we thought was mindful of fairness issues across the board. What I understand, and I admit candidly, is that it's a little bit unfair to this court what we're asking for. But it's not unprecedented.
And if interveners would be entitled to the Munsingware relief, that means the rule... that means the district court's order gets vacated, which means that would kick into play the 2015 rule until there's a change. Is that right?
Your Honor, that's why we think, this is why we struggled with a way to approach this issue for this court. That's why we think that the case is prudentially right now and will be moot when a new rule issues. and that eliminates the risk of confusion about the regulatory regime with the old rule kicking into place. Now, of course, my brothers over here would tell you also that before the new rule kicks into place, all of their arbitrary and capricious issues need to be resolved. So whatever this court decides, we're likely a long way from the 2015 rule hopping into effect.
Let me pursue that. So say we disagree with you, decide that we should decide whether BLM had authority to issue the rule. We vacate the permanent injunction. The district court has already indicated that it thinks the other issues, the other objections are likely to prevail and issued a preliminary injunction on that basis. And therefore, I guess it goes back to that court. There's one party, the NGOs, as you say, don't think we should send it back. But say we send it back, the district court then decides at the permanent injunction stage how it feels about the preliminary injunction issues, the other preliminary injunction issues. It comes back to us. We decide those. Then the case goes before the Supreme Court. Say somebody's going to be upset with the result, I assume. And while the Supreme Court, after it grants cert, before it decides the issue, the case, the new rule goes into effect. Then no one's decided authoritatively the authority issue. I mean, as a pragmatic reason, it's important to know authority, but as a pragmatic reason, is it likely that the issue of authority is actually determined in this dispute if the proposed rule is promulgated in essentially the proposed form within, say, the next 3 years?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm trying to get a feel for the pragmatic issue here. You're relying on pragmatic at this point.
Yeah. I mean,
we have some concerns about those.
Right. Your Honor, I want to answer your question. I want to make sure that I've gone for a lot of time, and I'm very mindful of, so I'm hoping the court will. I want to answer
this
with your permission. Yeah, so I think the way that we, you know, these are difficult issues, and the way that we assessed the pragmatic prudential concerns here was that, the president has made this a priority. The secretary has told the agency to do this expeditiously, that the best course would be to put this case on hold pending the promulgation of a new rule. And the agency will promulgate that rule with all options on the table. But at the time that that rule is promulgated, this case will be moot. And it's our submission that may be the least complicated way to deal with this, given all of the complexities of this litigation. And we come to this court in good faith, not trying to stake out a tails we win, heads you lose position, but trying to come up with an approach that we think is mindful of the judicial resources. And I say that, of course, cognizant of the fact that you've already spent considerable time on this dispute. I will yield my time to...
Well, are we going to get into merits?
I mean, I can briefly say about the merits, our position is relatively straightforward. As for the Mineral Leasing Act and FLTMA, the BLM's enabling statute, those statutes prescribe rulemaking authority to the agency. That is the sine qua non of their authority to act here, and it's something the district court failed to apprehend. And in terms of the Safe Drinking Water Act, there's a couple things going on. One is it's clear from the enactment in 1974 that Congress did not intend to displace any EPA authority. It is equally clear that the 2005 Energy Policy Act amendment was only intended to limit the agency's authority under some part C to regulate hydrofracking and was silent on the issue.
Okay, let me back up.
Yeah.
You say it's clear when the Safe Drinking Water Act was enacted that it wasn't to limit any EPA authority.
BLM authority.
You said EPA.
I apologize for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's start with the proposition that I'm sure you support, that BLM, absent the Safe Drinking Water Act, had authority, frankly.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that proposition.
Yes.
Strongly.
After the Safe Drinking Water Act, it may still have lots of authority over fracking, but perhaps not with respect to safe drinking water, protection of drinking water. There may be concerns about earthquakes. There may be concerns about destruction of Native American artifacts, things like that. But with respect to safe drinking water, why isn't this comprehensive statute, why shouldn't we interpret that as giving the exclusive authority to the agencies given authority by the Safe Drinking Water Act?
So the portion of the statute at issue here, the statute is the Safe Drinking Water Act. It has many provisions. The portion of the statute issue here relates to the control of underwater, of underground injection, right? It's the underground injection.
I'm talking about the statute as a whole.
But the 1974 legislative history made quite plain that they didn't intend to displace.
Well, that legislative history is strange because it's supported by no language in the statute. In fact, the language in the statute suggests otherwise. Can you tell me where that language in the committee report came from? Was there some discussion in some testimony, some letters from somebody? It just came out of nowhere, and it's not supported by the text at all.
But I guess to answer your specific question, I don't have a great answer for that off the top of my head. But to generally, right, the fracking rule that was promulgated here is entirely consistent with what BLM has been doing on the landscape for decades. Literally decades. And it relates
to... What do you mean by doing? I thought it had a rule that said something, but it had never been...
Well, it has always had rules in place to deal with groundwater issues, under the Mineral Leasing Act as well. So historically, this kind of regulation, which is exactly the kind of regulation you would expect BLM and not EPA to engage in. Remember that this rule goes to matters of petroleum engineering, the things that are in the heartland of BLM's expertise. Look, I think the fundamental problem with the safe drinking water analysis that the district court proffers is that it relies on the very, very high bar of implied repeal. We think that the record shows plainly that there was this authority.
That's a very high bar. I think the authority that talks about it has to be clear and so on was the 1929 case. And I'm thinking of more recent stuff, such as 1983, 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, Civil Rights Act, gives right to a suit against a state agency for depriving an employee of due process. And am I not correct that the Supreme Court has said that is superseded by the statute governing governing state employment, because that sort of occupies the field, so we don't, you can't bring a 1983 suit in that circumstance. But I'm sure it's done that in certain circumstances where they say 1983 is not the source of authority because there's a thorough statute that sets forth a system for dealing with these issues. Why is the Safe Drinking Water Act not in the same position?
Look,
given what I think, I tend to agree with you. Absent that, their authority to govern federal property is pretty broad.
The authority in at its enactment in 1974, this part of the program is a very modest part of the program, this underground injection, and it seems clear that they did not give any thought at all to sort of oil, gas operations, well stimulation techniques, which often require fluid. It seems clear from the legislative history that that was committed to BLM.
Go ahead and finish.
And so then great reliance was placed by the district court on the Energy Policy Act amendment. But that
I don't want to get to that yet.
Okay, that amendment is really focused, on Part C.
Let's keep it before the EP Act. Have other federal agencies, since the enactment of the Safe Drinking Water Act, have they enacted any regulations dealing with protection of drinking water? I couldn't find any. It looked like there seems to be at least an assumption by the federal agencies that protection of drinking water comes under the SDWA, and they have not exercised any authority through other statutory.
I think important to the premise of your question is that these fracking regs are...
I'm not talking about just fracking. I'm talking about...
No. I mean, I don't have an answer to you on
that. Let me maybe I haven't been clear what what I'm asking about in general is whether the Safe Drinking Water Act became the exclusive means of federal agencies protecting drinking water once it was enacted, and what evidence is there that agencies that was enacted a while back have other agencies exercised their authority in any way to protect drinking water, or have they just tried to enforce what EPA has done under the SDWA?
Well, I think that
you don't think that's relevant.
I think that other agencies protect water resources and drinking water in a wide variety of ways, in different manners, just as the fracking rule here does. Let me give you an example, right? We're in Colorado where there's a lot of Forest Service land. The Organic Act of the Forest Service is specifically directed in addition to providing sustainable timber harvest, to the protection of those waters. That is intended, right, to protect the water resources and the drinking water.
Have they
ever
tried to do it in a way that was different? I'm not saying inconsistent, but just different, additional, or different in any way from what the EPA and the states has delegated through the State Drinking Water Act.
I'm having difficulty with the premise, because I think that what BLM is doing here is fundamentally different from what EPA does under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that's the problem with the district court's analysis. He sort of went to a specific general canon and said, here Congress has specifically intended to deal with safe drinking water, and there's no room. But I think the district court has it exactly in the opposite in terms of the specific general canon. And let me tell you, this is my submission in that regard. The statutes that BLM is acting under and has acted under for a very long time are statutes grounded in the property clause, and they are intended to allow. So when BLM regulates in this area, it is regulating not just as in a public health or welfare way, but as a proprietor, as an owner of these lands. And I think that the district court fundamentally erred in suggesting
so
that.
Are you saying that Congress could not have restricted the authority of other agencies to control safe drinking water and just said, which the SDWA seems to say, other agencies should comply with these regulations?
Congress has immense power to regulate in this area. There's no question.
So the fact that you're saying, which I fully agree with you, that there's immense power to regulate federal land doesn't really answer the question about whether this SDWA was meant to concentrate that issue within the expertise of the EPA. That you can, I would grant you that then these other agencies can control fracking for a lot of other different reasons.
Well,
but with respect to protection of drinking water,
yeah.
Was that not carved out by the EPA?
And I think the fundamental disagreement that I respectfully have, Your Honor, is that I think that's an elephant. And I think that if Congress had intended to displace all of BLM's authority as a land manager to protect groundwater, that may ultimately end up as drinking water, Congress would have told us expressly, and it would be more clear.
And why didn't Congress include language saying that it was not overriding any other authority as it did with respect to states?
I think that again turns it on its head. I think, you know, one thing about the EPA amendment, respectfully, yeah. I'm going to mention that again, in 2005, is at that point there were no states regulating fracking, right? There was no role for the state. I think the assumption had to be in terms of mineral development on federal lands.
I think we need to hear from the other appellant. You're way over time.
Thank you very much.
I'll give the other appellant 10 minutes and give 10 minutes to the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Michael Freeman, appearing on behalf of the Citizen Group Intervenors. I'll start by addressing the merits and then turn to the abeyance issues. The District Court ruling on appeal is a dramatic departure from nearly a century of law and practice, and it would strip the federal government of its authority over 90% of the oil and gas development occurring on public lands today. BLM's request to stay this appeal would leave that decision in effect indefinitely while shielding it from appellate review. We ask this Court to decide the merits of this appeal and to reverse.
What about with respect to Indian land? You made no argument about that in response to the brief of the tribe, neither did the government. Shouldn't we affirm the District Court with respect to that issue, given the failure of the appellants to challenge that part of the ruling?
No, Your Honor. We think the issue before this Court goes to BLM's authority over federal land. The authority over Indian land question brought by the Ute Tribe hasn't been fully briefed, and the BLM has asked this Court.
They fully briefed it.
I'm sorry?
They briefed it.
Yes, Your Honor. The government didn't brief it.
And neither did you.
We would ask the Court, I think, before resolving the issue, and the District Court also didn't decide the issue. In order for that issue to be fully vetted and presented to this Court.
If an issue is fully presented to the District Court, and it's an alternative ground for affirmance, and it's raised by the appellee in its brief, we expect the appellants to deal with that issue. And all you said is don't decide it. I don't think you said anything. I think the government said don't decide it. It seems to be at the least a plausible argument. And generally in that circumstance, we'll just say you've conceded that point. You've waived the issue on appeal.
2 points, Your Honor. First, this Court normally does not decide an issue that was not decided below. And this issue was not one that the lower court resolved. And for this Court to fully address it and get the entire picture, it needs to benefit a briefing on both sides. The most efficient approach and the best way to ensure that this Court reaches the right result is to remand to allow the District Court to resolve it.
So we should not affirm on alternative grounds that were presented below, fully presented to the Court below. We shouldn't address that, even though, I mean, that's really contrary to a lot of our practice.
Your Honor, that's what we're asking the Court to do. We have not taken the position about the Ute's claims. They relate to a relatively small fraction of the whole rule. It's about 50 million acres out of 750 million acres. If at an absolute minimum this Court should reverse with regard to the federal law authority and order the rule reinstated with regard to federal lands, we think the appropriate course with regard to that tail issue of the 50 million Indian acres would be to remand for further proceedings. But the Court should not let the tail wag the dog here by reaffirming the entire holding based on that one small part of it. With regard to the merits on the federal lands issue, I think it's important for the Court to remember that this rule addresses activities that the Interior Department has managed on public lands for nearly a century. These are things like well construction standards or requirements for waste management, as well as agency approvals of oil and gas operations. And in particular, BLM regulations for more than 30 years have had some limited provisions addressing hydraulic fracturing. All this rule does is to update the agency's existing regulations to account for changes in practice and technology since the 1980s. And we agree with the BLM that the Mineral Leasing Act and FLTMA give the agency well-established authority to update its rules in the way it has here. The lower court, as you mentioned, found what amounted to an effective partial repeal of the MLA and FLTMA as part of an entirely different statute, the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that implied repeal finding was wrong because the court's role is to give effect to all three statutes where it's possible to do so, the Mineral Leasing Act and FLTMA and SIDWA. And giving effect to all three statutes simply requires applying the 2005 amendment according to its plain language. That amendment made a change to SIDWA, but it didn't make any change to either the Mineral Leasing Act or to FLTMA.
Are you aware of any federal regulations enacted since CIDWA by any agency other than EPA that purport to protect drinking water?
Again, Your Honor, I think BLM's and the Interior Department's regulations on public lands have managed and regulated underground injections and groundwater for many decades.
But that wasn't quite what I was asking. I'm asking about regulations after CIDWA that purport that whose purpose is purportedly to protect drinking water.
I think the actual EPA's own CIDWA regulations reflect that other agencies do have a role in administering this, even with CIDWA. I think it's 40 CFR, I believe 144.4. It's a regulation cited in our brief, where EPA's own regulations say that in getting a CIDWA underground injection permit, the applicant also has to comply with other regulations and other laws that are administered by other federal agencies. So it's very clear, and EPA has been clear about this for decades, that while CIDWA is broadly designed to cover a broad range of underground injections, it's never been intended to be the exclusive statute governing underground injections. There's a big difference between saying EPA has broad regulatory authority and saying that EPA is the only agency that can exercise that authority.
So EPA exercising authority as it relates to underground injections for its purpose, regulating safe drinking water, does not bar the regulation of underground injections with a different aim in mind?
That's right, Your Honor. I think I would point the Court to the Supreme Court's Massachusetts versus EPA decision, which said that even where the activities involved may overlap, where different agencies have independent statutory authority, there's no conflict. And I think that's what we have here. While the activities managed under the MLA and FLTMA may overlap with those under CIDWA, that's not a conflict because these are very different statutes administered by completely different agencies.
I don't have a problem with your general proposition. But the way it was briefed, I thought, missed an important point. This is all the briefs, actually. And that is, there's a difference between saying the BLM can regulate fracking for various different purposes. I mentioned earthquakes or affecting Native American artifacts. The question is whether CIDWA removes the authority. It vests all authority to protect safe drinking water under the provisions of CIDWA. And you still haven't responded to that. Yes, EPA has these safe drinking water regulations. Those same activities can be regulated by other agencies that have interests other than protecting safe drinking water. And that's what I was asking. Are there any regulations by other agencies designed to protect safe drinking water that have been enacted since CIDWA was promulgated?
Yes, I think I'd point to the BLM's regulations from 1982, which required protection of groundwater as part of administering oil and gas operations, and those regulations were adopted after 1974.
Okay, that's important. And where are those regs?
I'm sorry?
Tell me about those regs.
Yeah, those are cited in our brief. I believe it's at page... it's in our opening briefing, or I can find the site for you if you like. I think it's also important to remember here that, as I mentioned, the MLA and FLTMA are land management statutes governing BLM's role as the proprietor of public lands. CIDWA is an environmental regulatory statute that goes to EPA's regulatory authority over private activities on private lands as well as on public lands. And the fact that there's an overlap between those statutes is not an indication of a conflict.
And to that point, teasing out something Judge Hartz was talking about, would it be your view that the BLM, exercising its role as property owner, could regulate injection to protect safe drinking water, whereas the EPA, pursuing its regulatory mission, its purpose, could do the same thing? In other words, CIDWA would not prevent the BLM from regulating with the purpose of protecting safe drinking water, but it's doing so in pursuance of its property owner mission.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And I think there's other examples where that exact dynamic takes place. For example, BLM routinely, when it approves activities on public lands, will impose requirements to prevent pollution of rivers or streams, or to prevent harm from wildlife, even though there are other federal environmental laws like the Clean Water Act or the Endangered Species Act that address the same resources. So that kind of overlap is not a sign of a conflict, it's just a reality of land management law.
May I ask about the ED Act? We haven't really discussed that yet.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed
it. May I ask about the ED Act? We haven't really discussed that yet.
Yes, sir.
EP Act.
The 2005 Act, Your Honor, yes.
When Congress eliminated the EPA's authority to regulate fracking with respect to safe drinking water, what was the reason given?
Your Honor, the primary reason for the 2005 CIDWA amendment was to overturn the 11th Circuit's Leith decision, which was it didn't involve public lands at all. It was a private land CIDWA hydraulic fracturing operation. I think when you look at the text of the 2005 Act as a whole, it's very clear that Congress did not intend that change to extend beyond CIDWA to address the MLA.
Well, let me ask about that. What was the reason given? I thought there had been some studies or some report that there was no need to regulate fracking. It did not pose a threat to drinking water. Is that correct?
That's right. One of the rationales offered for the 2005 Act was that EPA had done a study that found that, and this was a study that frankly was subject to a lot of dispute and challenge at the time from other experts in the field. But what the study said was that unless there's diesel fuel involved, fracking poses limited risk. And that was part of the rationale for amending CIDWA to change EPA's authority. But what's notable here is that Congress made a number of other changes in that same 2005 Act to the MLA on issues other than fracking. So Congress, I think there were 7 amendments to the MLA in the 2005 Act, and yet Congress didn't see fit to extend its CIDWA hydraulic fracturing change to the MLA. And I think that is very strong evidence to suggest that the district court overread the import of the 2005 Act.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Yeah, yes.
Go ahead. One question.
The interpretation of opposing counsel, I think, is that the failure to mention it with respect to other agencies is that it was assumed by Congress that those other agencies didn't have any authority to control fracking with respect to safe drinking water. How do you respond to that?
Oh, I would say I'd first go back to the 1974 legislative history of CIDWA. Originally, when Congress originally passed it, it said it did not intend the underground injection provisions of CIDWA to limit or alter the Interior Department's authority over those activities on public lands. So when Congress is assumed to legislate against the backdrop of its earlier understanding when it adopted CIDWA, and it's understood to legislate with the knowledge of how BLM and the other agencies have been interpreting that law. Here, given that background knowledge, there's no reason to think that this was simply an oversight by Congress. The Congress was focused on a particular problem involving CIDWA and private lands. There's no evidence in either the legislative history or the structure or the text of the MLA to believe that Congress intended to go broader than that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time, so
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could we divide the other side? 12 minutes now. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is James Casti. I'm a Deputy Attorney General with the Wyoming Attorney General's Office, appearing today on behalf of the states of Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah. I had planned to speak for 8 minutes, but I'll maybe try to shoot for 11 and then turn it over to Counsel for North Dakota.
You don't have to use all your time, but fire at will.
I find it's much harder to leave the podium when I'm being asked lots of questions, and that tends to happen. I'd like to begin with three points that I'd like to make about the merits, but before that, I think there's an interesting quote in one of the cases that was cited to you in these proceedings that I think really ought to govern how we view this statutory authority question. And that's a quote from Chief Justice Warren in the Udall versus Talman case. And he said, "Government is a practical matter intended for practical men. When Congress intends to give two agencies the exact same job, I think practical men
persons?
Should expect
Can
them
we
to say that.
Persons?
Persons. I'm sorry. It was a different time.
Amuse me.
Like I say, but when Congress intends to give two agencies the same job, I think practical people should and would expect them to do so very clearly. You know, I think that this case is governed by some pretty simple principles, the first of which being...
It's not the same job, is it? They're doing it for different purposes. And you can have people regulating the same activity, but they're regulating it for different purposes, different aims. So they're not doing the same job. They're just addressing the same activity.
No, they're doing exactly the same job. And that points to a real problem associated with the Bureau's construction of these two statutes is we could have wellbore construction standards from each of these two agencies that differ, putting industry in an impossible position of not being able to comply with one by complying with the other.
Well, one could be more rigorous than the other. That doesn't mean that they couldn't comply. They would just comply with the higher standard, right?
I suppose in any given situation, it could be that one would be the better course than the other, but that's not really how Congress and these things ought to work. When Congress gives one agency a job, very clearly, Brown and Williamson and those cases that led up to us tell us the courts must adjust their construction of the prior, more general statute in order to accommodate the new situation on the ground created by Congress.
You don't think BLM still has authority to regulate fracking if they're concerned about earthquakes? You think that authority was eliminated?
Yes. I can say
really?
That plainly because the Safe Drinking Water Act talks about the emplacement of fluids in the ground and that is EPA's job to control that. That particular
to protect safe drinking water. That's the only reason they have to control it under SDWA.
But the Underground Injection Control Program is a comprehensive regulatory scheme governing the underground injection of fluids. The purpose for which EPA was given that authority.
The EPA Act removed that authority from the EPA because there was no need, studies showed, there was no real need to regulate that since fracking posed a minimal danger to drinking water. But that doesn't mean BLM couldn't say, look, this fracking is causing a lot of problems with earthquakes. I'm not saying whether that's correct or not, but wouldn't they have authority then to say something about fracking use of fracking to produce oil and say we can control that to reduce earthquakes?
Well, I think one of the points that I'd like to get across here today is that it's not the state's position that the Bureau of Land Management is precluded from regulating for the protection of the environment or that it has no role as a result of this hydraulic fracturing regulation. The Bureau of Land Management has immense control over the public lands, the leasing process, the process of producing oil and gas. The one thing it can't really do, though, is regulate hydraulic fracturing because Congress, even though the Mineral Leasing Act may have arguably granted them that power back when it was promulgated, Congress ended the argument in 1974 when it gave exclusive authority over hydraulic fracturing to the Environmental Protection Agency. It's difficult to believe that Congress, without saying a word about
it. What in the text of the SDWA says anything about exclusive authority? I mean,
well, the 11th Circuit in Leaf said that the Safe Drinking Water Act gave the Environmental Protection Agency control over all underground injection, including hydraulic fracturing. And the court went out of its way
relative
to emphasize
the
word all.
Okay. Go ahead.
I just think it's difficult to say that the Environmental Protection Agency, as determined by the Leaf Court, was given authority over all underground injection and then say, but no, not really. Some other agency also has that authority. Those two positions are in irreconcilable conflict.
Why are they irreconcilable when one can say that the EPA, in pursuance of its mission, has exclusive authority over underground injection to protect safe drinking water, whereas some other agency pursuing its own mission under a whole different constitutional structure has the authority to regulate underground injection to further its mission. I mean, I may be slow, but those things don't seem very irreconcilable to me.
You're not slow. The Safe Drinking Water Act, when it delegated to EPA its authority, it delegated it over the process of underground injection. The purpose is one thing, but the mandate from Congress was to regulate the process, and it did not give some other agency authority over that process. And so whether one entity or another has an interest in the process for different reasons is sort of irrelevant to the authority granted to the Environmental Protection Agency, which was specific to this activity. That activity belongs within EPA's control as of 1974, and that's exactly what the Leaf Court said. And the Bureau cannot avoid that judicial construction by saying, I'm entitled to deference. The Bureau doesn't get to overrule the court, where the court has determined that the statute unambiguously allocates all authority over underground injections to the EPA. As I mentioned, I think that this is a case governed by the Brown and Williamson line of cases. And I think that what Brown and Williamson says is something different than the doctrine of implied repeal. I agree that an implied repeal is a very high bar, but one that we don't have to meet in this case. The Brown and Williamson line of cases, I like to think of them as almost a soft repeal or a repeal light, because they're not a change in the statutory language of the earlier general statute, but they're an alteration of the judicial construction of how far that general statute goes. And that's all that Judge Skavdal found in this case, is that when Congress enacted a subsequent, more specific, comprehensive statute, he and the judiciary have to utilize that new information to adjust their construction of the previous, more generic statute. That's how Congress tends to work, and we have to respect that line drawing by Congress that this activity is best suited for regulation by the Environmental Protection Agency, and then subsequently that this activity is best suited for regulation by the states because of the apparent lack of harm at the time that the Energy Policy Act was promulgated. This seems to me to be a very practical, pragmatic, and obvious answer to the way in which these statutory regimes developed and interact. Were it not so, the Bureau of Land Management could act as a super or mini, I can't tell which analogy is right, Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, it has a lot of control over federal land. You've got to accept that.
Absolutely. And I do not believe, and I think the interveners have sort of characterized this as a sort of radical diminishment of the Bureau's authority over the public lands. That's not true. That is the event that occurred in 1974 carves out one specific technology and process and says this is best suited for the Environmental Protection Agency, not for the Bureau. Everything else that is arguably within the power of the Bureau under the Mineral Leasing Act remains. And that's a lot of power. The Bureau can simply say, we're not leasing this land. The Bureau can say, we're not leasing it now. The Bureau can impose conditions on leases on a wide variety of matters. And I think it's worth noting that there's nothing in the state's challenge to this particular regulation that affects the existing onshore orders. There is a lot of regulation going on already by the Bureau of Land Management that is wholly unaffected by the promulgation of this particular hydraulic fracturing regulation. And nothing about what the states are saying goes to the Bureau's authority to conduct those activities, even though those activities are intended primarily or tangentially to benefit the environment. The Bureau can do that, and we don't take issue with that proposition. There's a specific, small carve-out created by Congress, a line drawn by Congress, that we have to respect. That's the sum total of our argument. How am I doing?
Very well. We've got it.
I think I've said everything that I came here to say, unless the court has specific questions for these states with regard to the supplemental briefing. If not, I'll turn it over to my co-counsel. Thank you very much for your time, and we would ask that the district court's opinion be affirmed.
Thank you.
Good morning. Paul Seabee on behalf of the state of North Dakota. Given the pendency of the BLM's proposed rescission rule, North Dakota concurs that abeyance is proper and would promote judicial efficiency. But if the court reaches the merits of the BLM and the environmental group's appeal, then the provisions of the Safe Drinking Water Act and the amendment thereto, the Energy Policy Act of 2005, respectfully mandate this court affirm the district court's decision. This case is about a 28-month-old rule that has never taken effect, for which the United States has just this week initiated a public notice and comment rulemaking to rescind. Not only would proceeding be an inefficient use of this court's resources, it would also put this court in a position of offering potentially an advisory opinion about a soon-to-be non-existent rule.
How about dismissal?
Dismissal of the appeal would be acceptable to us, provided the court not vacate the district court's decision. Because...
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
Judge, it's because this whole circumstance, it either sets into effect mooting the appeal or dismissing the appeal, is a result of the sponsoring agency's change in policy.
But it's not the responsibility of the intervener appellants. They didn't cause this. Why isn't this a happenstance as it relates to them?
It's not because the underlying cause and the primary cause is the sponsoring agency's action that would be the cause of either a moot circumstance or a dismissal.
Well, we have a case called Wyoming versus U.S. Department of Agriculture, in which you had an intervener who appealed when the agency did not appeal. The agency revoked the rule or rescinded the rule, and we vacated. And we vacated, but as we said, as it relates to that intervener, they didn't do this. It's why should they bear the burden of whatever the agency's whim is at the moment in time?
Judge, I'm very familiar with that case.
Okay.
I'd also call your attention to, well, let me start with the premise that the reason we asked to file a reply in the supplemental briefing was because for the first time the United States and the environmental groups raised Munsingware.
Yes.
And Munsingware is not the governing test for vacature in this instance, and that's because the Supreme Court subsequently narrowed the Munsingware test in a case called Bancor, which this court has acknowledged several times. And with respect to the case you mentioned, Judge Holmes, it's a very different posture than that facing the court in this case, where that case, of course, involved the multi-chapter circumstances with regard to snowmobiling in the Yellowstone. And there, the Park Service did not take an appeal of the case that was then later vacated. That's very different than here. The BLM has taken this appeal.
Well, but the analysis went to the question of what do you do about an intervener that did not engage in unilateral action to result in what essentially was the mooting of the appeal. And if we were to say here that this was either prudentially unripe or prudentially moot, then you'd be in a situation of what do you do about the underlying district court order? And as it relates to the intervener appellants, they didn't do anything. They're along for the ride. They're ready to hear this thing out. It's only because of the unilateral action of the government that we're in the posture we are now.
Well, I think, again, I go back to the very different posture that case that you're mentioning, the Wyoming case, it doesn't apply here.
What's the difference? I wasn't clear what that is.
Well, I think as a practical matter, the district court's decision in that case was already effectively vacated by the circumstances of the Tenth Circuit rendering its decision.
But if we call this case prudentially unripe, then the point it will be no different than a situation. Well, explain to me why that is different in a situation in which the agency has moved to rescind the rule. I mean, they're both operating on the same track, aren't they? One is a matter of pragmatism. The other is a matter of what, in fact, has already happened. But, I mean, the result is the same in terms of it seems to me the question we're asked to evaluate is whether they have a distinct equitable interest, they being the intervener appellants, from the people who unilaterally caused this thing to essentially fizzle out. Do you acknowledge that they do have a distinct equitable interest here?
Well, a couple of points I think I would say, and that is, one, they have an obligation under Article 3 to independently demonstrate standing. That's not occurred yet in our position, and I think our sister states. So that's number one. Number two,
Wyoming said we wouldn't have to reach the standing issue if we were to vacate. We wouldn't have to do that.
The problem we have with that outcome is that you're giving them a result they could not obtain in the district court, and that is having a decision where the outcome is that decision in the district court goes away. That's handing them a win that they didn't earn in the district court, and that's not fair to North Dakota or our sister states or the other petitioners. So it's a fundamental issue on that point, Judge.
One thing you said interested me. You said soon-to-be-replaced regulation or language to that effect. Can you give us any reason to be more optimistic that the new proposed rule will take effect in less than 5 years?
Well, I broke my crystal ball a long time ago.
Okay.
So I would just say that, as the government said, and that is that we're here before the court as a matter of circumstance that started with a change in the administration and shortly thereafter issued executive order that specifically called out this regulation for review and action. And so with that point, I would say, Judge Hartz, that without Judge Holmes, earlier you said it's not your job to be subject to the whim of the executive branch with respect to your docket. Completely understand this court has its control over its docket, but I do think there's a larger principle of comity between the branches that comes into play here, and that is that the judicial branch, your sister circuits, the D.C. Circuit in particular, in this very context of where a change in the administrations has occurred, the executive branch gets to have a reasonable amount of time to execute any changes in prerogatives it wishes to pursue.
But counsel, in those cases that are before the D.C. Circuit, most of those that where the circuit determines that they'll hold a case in abeyance, those are petitions for review that are not reviewing district court rulings. They're direct reviews filed by petitioners with the circuit. We don't have that here. We have an underlying decision by the district court that is on the books, ripe for decision, I would argue. Why shouldn't we proceed?
Absolutely right, and we're involved in a number of those D.C. Circuit cases, and so I can tell you firsthand, I'm understanding.
So you see the difference?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But the circumstance, I think, that also cuts in our favor is that this rule never took effect, and the sponsoring agency has told the court in very clear terms that...
Beyond the rule, the specific rule, we have the overarching decision by the district court that remains effective, which states that the BLM has no authority in this area at all.
With respect to this rule?
Right. Well, with respect to fracking, generally.
Yeah. No, I understand. And we're not scared of the merits. We're proud of the resolve obtained in the district court. We believe the district court got it right.
Why?
As a matter of Chevron, I think that the court absolutely looked at this in the right context. We had other issues that were presented to the court as to authority regarding federal versus state.
You heard the discussion about the merits. Why do you think that BLM didn't have the authority? Or is that not an issue you're going to be addressing?
No, I'm pleased to do that. I'm here to talk about both the abeyance and the merits circumstances, and no concern about getting into the merits discussion at all.
I want to cut off.
Go ahead.
So I guess the pursuant to Chevron, the district court got it right because the issue of authority to regulate hydraulic fracturing, the practice of hydraulic fracturing, first the court recognized that the 11th Circuit in the Leaf case made clear that Congress conferred authority on EPA to regulate underground injections, all of them, including hydraulic fracturing under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And then along came the amendment to the Safe Drinking Water Act in 2005, amending the definition of underground injection to specifically exclude hydraulic fracturing from EPA's purview. Congress clearly elected to leave the control of that, the regulation of that practice in the capable hands of the states, us.
Well, you heard the arguments to the contrary. How do you How do you respond to that, that the EP Act just limited EPA's authority, other agencies, independent sources of authority, why can't they still regulate fracking for purposes? Go ahead.
Yep, Judge Hartz, absolutely, and I think that makes it right for me to say that unequivocally, BLM's position with regard to authority is absolutely backwards. And I say that because the BLM, like any federal agency's authority, is limited by the power delegated to that agency by Congress. Agencies are creatures of statute. They have no more authority than what Congress gives to them. It is not the converse. It is not a, I can do whatever I want to unless Congress tells me I can't. That is not how our constitutional system of government, and particularly the authority of executive branch agencies, works. And so I would...
authority granted to the BLM under those statutes. Absent the SDWA, at least.
Perhaps, and I, you know, there's no quibble with the broad grant of authority over public lands, federal lands, to the land management agencies. But again, it has to be in a context.
You have no quarrel with that, you say?
Not in the big context, but I mean, this issue cannot be looked at in that broad of a context. It's more finite and mechanical than that. And one of the mechanical points that I think, from North Dakota's standpoint, that we made clear in the district court is that the Supreme Court has long recognized that states have traditional and fundamental authority, inherent authority, over land use and water. And North Dakota's constitution, for example, Wyoming's constitution, for example, Colorado's constitution, for example, gives the water of the state, belongs to the citizens of the state, and it's the property and the jurisdictional domain of the states. And it's not, and that includes with respect to on the public lands, and that is...
Well, so are wild animals, and there's a specific Supreme Court opinion saying whatever BLM, I don't know what the agency was at the time, wants to do with respect to wild animals in New Mexico, the state can't override that.
Yes, and I think the immediate distinction there, Judge, is that it's on the surface. What I'm talking about with respect to water and... come to land in a moment, but water. In North Dakota's instance, this regulation that we challenged as one of the parties that sought and obtained a preliminary injunction was this regulation, BLM articulated, takes the federal mineral interest. In North Dakota, we don't have large swaths of public lands on the surface. The federal interest is just small amounts of mineral scattered around the state as a historical function of the Depression and the Bankhead Jones Act circumstance described in our briefs. And so that this rule took that small presence and said anytime that exists, no matter how small, in a spacing unit or a communitized area for the efficient development of those resources, the federal government takes that little piece and leverages authority over the rest of the spacing unit. That's our authority to regulate the water and the oil and gas industry and the development of those resources. And so that is an excursion well beyond the federal government's lawful authority, constitutional authority.
Well, in this unitization process, does the producer not have the discretion to decide we're just not going to seek mineral rights, we're not going to drill with respect to the federal land in this area? Is that possible under unitization?
It's not. The whole concept of communitization is not a federal-induced program. It's the state of North Dakota, for example, and our sister states have the same approach. The whole reason for communitization is so that the resources are developed in an efficient and non-wasteful manner, so that the communitized approach, the management approach, does not allow those resources to be...
How would the BLM rule... regulation prevent that?
It doesn't prevent it. It just says, as a function of that, whenever we're in that neighborhood, we regulate, and therefore this rule takes over everything in the neighborhood of the communitized area. And that's improper because that's a federal excursion into our authority, and that is to regulate our own natural gas and oil producing entities on private land and state land, and it tells us what to do with respect to the regulation of those things, and displaces us.
How different are the federal regulations than the North Dakota regulations?
I'm sorry, Judge. I'm
sorry. How different are the federal regulations from the North Dakota regulations?
Well, it was flattering to read that they were at least initially modeled after North Dakota's longstanding hydraulic fracturing regulations, but they departed from them substantially and conflict with them with respect to technical specifications and so forth. And those are irreconcilable conflicts because the state wishes to maintain its authority, number one. Number two is the federal government cannot intrude on our authority just by using a small piece of federal mineral to leverage the rest of the communitized area.
Do you know how typical North Dakota's land division of land ownership is with respect to mineral rights? Is it something that there's reason to think that the Congress thought about in this area? I just don't know if this sort of checkerboard ownership is typical of oil and gas lands in the country. You pointed out how why it is in North Dakota, but that was for peculiar historical reasons.
Well, I can say that the Bankhead Jones Act was not a statute and a circumstance in the Depression era transfer of those surface and the splitting of the surface and the subsurface estates was not just limited to North Dakota. It happened to be prevalent in North Dakota. I know the circumstance exists in Colorado and Wyoming and Montana and Utah. Okay. Being able to tell you, Judge, how proportionally relative to North Dakota, I can't do that. But the circumstance exists throughout the West. So is my time up?
You tell me.
Well,
you have two other gentlemen waiting to argue.
And I will respect them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the Court, Mark Barron on behalf of the Independent Petroleum Association of America and the Western Energy Alliance. In my brief time, and I will be sensitive to our friends, the Indian tribe, I intend to first speak to Judge Hartz's question about the relationship between BLM's legal position in this case and the agency's customary regulation of underground injections to protect drinking water. And hopefully this will also address Judge Holmes's questions about concomitant authority. And then second, I'd like to explain why Chevron is not the appropriate analytical framework for this case. And I do think that these two points will relate to each other. Let me begin with BLM's customary interpretation of the statute on which this case turns, the Safe Drinking Water Act. So our friend from Wyoming indicated earlier, the Safe Drinking Water Act allocates regulatory authority over underground injections. The federal appellate court in Leaf held that that term underground injections includes hydraulic fracturing. And for purposes of oil and gas production, BLM has historically considered the term underground injection to relate to at least four categories of activity on federal lands. The first two categories include, first, wells in which fluids are injected into a reservoir for what is conventionally known as enhanced oil recovery. And the second are disposal wells for recovered fluids from oil and gas operations. And Judge Hartz, your question earlier about earthquakes, these are the types of injections that are typically associated with vulnerability to seismic activities. EPA regulates both of these categories as Class II injection wells under the Safe Drinking Water Act under regulations contained at 40 CFR Part 144. BLM, in its own currently existing regulations, apart from the hydraulic fracturing rule, concedes that EPA is the regulatory authority for both categories. In Onshore Order No. 7, BLM states expressly that for injection wells on federal and Indian lands, including both enhanced recovery and disposal wells, the operator must obtain an underground injection control permit from EPA. The regulatory preamble of the hydraulic fracturing rule confirms that understanding. The 2015 rule expressly excludes enhanced recovery from the definition of hydraulic fracturing. And BLM's regulatory preamble notes on appendix page 4795 that I'm quoting here, disposal of recovered fluids is done under the authority of other agencies such as the EPA for underground injection. So let me turn a little bit to the EPA Act of 2005, because the third category of underground injections is hydraulic fracturing using diesel. During the rulemaking, numerous commentators requested that BLM ban the use of diesel in hydraulic fracturing operations on federal and Indian lands. BLM declined, explaining, and I'm quoting again from page 4820 of the record, the regulation of diesel fuel in hydraulic fracturing fluids is committed to EPA under the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Energy Policy Act. So a question earlier before, I think Mr. Freeman raised EPA's own regulations and what EPA's understanding is of the relationship between EPA and BLM, and this may address Judge Holmes' concern. EPA's understanding is articulated in CFR 40 CFR 144.4, and there EPA lists the related statutes, that's a term of art in EPA's regulations, related statutes that relate to the issuance of permits for underground injection under all three of the categories I've just referenced. That statute lists specific other related statutes that include things like the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, the Endangered Species Act, Coastal Zone Management Act. It articulates specific statutes. 144.4 does not list the Mineral Leasing Act or FLTMA. It does not list any of those statutes as being relevant to underground injections on federal lands. So the only category of underground injection related to oil and gas production that BLM attempts to regulate is now non-diesel hydraulic fracturing. But EPA's original source for authority over all forms of underground injection is the Safe Drinking Water Act. BLM concedes that it can't regulate enhanced oil recovery, disposal wells, or hydraulic fracturing using diesel because Congress has designated EPA as the agency with regulatory authority over those forms, and it cannot now escape the same conclusion with respect to non-diesel hydraulic fracturing. BLM not only asked this court to consider this argument inconsistent with both its customary practice and the rationale in the regulatory process, but to give this new argument Chevron deference. The industry petitioners believe Chevron is inapplicable for at least three reasons.
Wait, are you not arguing that Chevron is applicable in binding the BLM to its view that these other activities are given exclusively to the EPA? Because if we grant that Chevron deference, that gets you quite a ways. Are you saying those statements are not entitled to Chevron deference?
I understand the question, Judge Harris. I think to be intellectually consistent, though, we have to focus on what we think is the ultimate question in this case. And while BLM and the interveners spend the overwhelming majority of their briefing pages on whether BLM has properly interpreted the Mineral Leasing Act and FLTMA, the ultimate question in this case does not depend on the scope of the agency's authority under those general management statutes. The point instead is whether the Safe Drinking Water Act, as amended by the Energy Policy Act, precludes BLM from regulating hydraulic fracturing. And since BLM...
But what you quoted, maybe I misunderstood, seems to suggest that the BLM has taken the position that the EPA has exclusive authority on these activities governed by the SDWA. And I would think that would be a very strong argument on your behalf, but I'm not sure whether you're saying that or not.
I understand. I think that we are showing, as I think useful evidence, that BLM has interpreted its authority over underground injections historically to be limited, and that underground injections for the purposes of oil and gas activities, that regulatory authority over that process has been allocated to the Energy Policy Act. I certainly would appreciate if this court wanted to grant that interpretation Chevron deference. But I think that's a slightly different question, and that's sort of evidence in support of why their interpretation on the law on this question is wrong, but it's not necessarily the ultimate Chevron question.
The reason it's important to me is because I'm grappling with whether the SDWA gave the EPA exclusive authority, exclusive of other federal agencies, not the states, over the protection of drinking water. And
well, I think then what I would say, Judge Hart, is I would turn to BLM's own regulatory history in this field to indicate whether or not that authority has been exercised exclusively or not. There has been talk about these regulations regulating similar activities to hydraulic fracturing. I think that was what Mr. Mergen said. And there's a citation in the government's brief to a 1942 regulation that requires approval before stimulating production by vacuum, acid, gas, air, water injection, or any other method.
Are you aware of any such regulations after the enactment of the SDWA?
No, and so this is the point. Two points here, Your Honor. First of all, even this regulation, these types of activities that are listed in the old regs, are expressly excluded from the definition of hydraulic fracturing in the 2015 rule. If you go to the definition section, it says hydraulic fracturing means injection, and hydraulic fracturing does not mean enhanced oil recovery, tertiary recovery, some of these other activities. And then I think subsequent to 1974, we have EPA enacting a comprehensive Class 2 injection permitting regulatory program. And the only regulation that anybody on this side of the aisle has cited is the 1982 regulation, which makes a vague reference to fracturing, not hydraulic fracturing, to fracturing, and which is, all parties admit, and I'll point you to the intervener's brief at page 32, has never been enforced. Operators have always considered hydraulic fracturing to not require approval. So you have one agency with a comprehensive regulatory program and another where if any aspect of hydraulic fracturing is referenced in their regulation, it's not subject to approval or monitoring or regulation under that reg. So I would argue that the regulatory history of the two agencies demonstrates the point that EPA has exercised exclusive authority over underground injections, including hydraulic fracturing, since 1974. Your Honors, in the interest of respect for the U Tribe, I will yield the last 5 minutes unless there are any questions from the Court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jeffrey Rasmussen here on behalf of the Ute Indian Tribe, which is located in northeastern Utah and has a very substantial amount of oil and gas production. Their economy is dependent upon it, and that's why we're here today. I really want to make two primary points. Before getting to those, we are in agreement with the United States with regard to abeyance and to the other appellees with regard to the Safe Drinking Water Act. But outside of those issues, the tribe has an important issue here, which is whether the agency has rulemaking authority, BLM, whether BLM has rulemaking authority with regard to tribal lands. And they've discussed whether they have some regulatory authority with regard to tribal lands, and that's not the issue we have here today. We're talking about rulemaking. They don't have rulemaking authority. In our brief, we go through in great detail the regulations and the laws with regard to BLM's authority, BIA's authority, and what we have, the primary point that I want to make is with regard to, and we go through a series of the United States argument, which they didn't make to this court, they made only in the district court below, and that's the only way we know their argument even. But their argument is that this is they can do this based upon this being restricted lands. And as we discussed in our brief, there's a lot of problems with their argument. But this is the easy one. This is a pure legal question. Restricted lands are one type of land that tribes or tribal members can own, and Indian trust lands are a completely different type. Those are mutually exclusive. So when they cite to a statute that gives the BIA regulatory authority with regard to restricted lands, we know that that doesn't include tribal trust lands. BIA never then delegated that authority to BLM, so the rulemaking authority, but we don't even need to reach that issue because it doesn't apply to tribal trust lands. Restricted lands are lands that there is a fee patent.
And in that very important definitional distinction, did the district court get it right? Or did it even talk about it?
It didn't talk about it, and that's the second point
right.
I want to talk about
right.
here today, because we do have a procedural issue, and the United States has said, well, don't reach the tribal law issues. And as Judge Hartz pointed out earlier, the standard rule is if it's sufficiently in the record that this court will reach it. The case law that discusses that, it will make a distinction between something that's really much more fact-intensive or where there's in a case like this, an APA case, where you really have to go through the record in detail. But here we're talking about a pure legal issue.
That you raised in the district court.
That we raised in the district court. And I want to point out that in their opening brief, the United States referenced tribal lands, Indian lands, tribes 80 times. They didn't provide an analysis, but they were certainly raising the issue, saying, yeah, this rule applies to Indian lands. Then in their reply brief, they completely cut that out. They only referenced tribal lands four times, and it's to say, don't touch that issue, even though they noted it 80 times in their opening brief. So they've certainly had the opportunity to brief the issue. As somebody who practices quite a bit of appellate law now, I know that if I'm the side that is doing the appeal, that I've got to preemptively discuss Are there any other issues that you could affirm based upon this record? This is one that's clearly in the record. It's a nice, pure legal issue. You certainly can reach it.
Let me ask what the posture would be if we decide that the BLM did have authority to enact its regulation with respect to federal land. What would we say with respect to Indian land? All trust land, it would still apply? Because you seem to have conceded that with respect to restricted land, the BLM may have authority. At least you haven't pursued why, and any Indian-specific reasons why it couldn't apply to restricted land. So would be the would our judgment, in your view, in that circumstance, be to say that the district court decision should be upheld with respect to trust lands? How would we...
Right. I'm here on behalf of the Ute Tribe, and we only have trust land. So we don't have restricted land on our reservation, so it's not so much my concern. But the second part of our argument with regard to BLM's rulemaking authority is that it does not have rulemaking authority with any of these Indian lands. And that's in our
Even
brief.
Even trust lands.
What?
Even trust lands.
Trust lands or restricted lands. That BIA has a rulemaking authority with regard to restricted lands. BIA does. But the United States is saying somehow that BLM got that authority, and it didn't. BIA is exercising its rulemaking authority with regard to restricted lands and, to some extent, with regard to trust lands. That's its authority, not BLM's. BLM doesn't have rulemaking authority with any Indian lands. But that's, as I say, not our issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. 2 minutes rebuttal. 2 minutes.
I'd give him more.
Have a 1:30 plan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure.
On the Indian lands issue, I think this issue is covered pretty extensively in our reply brief on the merits, and we think that the issue should be, meaning that we submit that the issue should be remanded. The district court's holding on this issue.
Did your reply brief address their arguments on the merits?
It does not address it on the merits. It says that if you look at the record here, it's clearly appropriate to be sent back, and we submit that that's consistent with this court's case law. It is not the case, as Mr. Rasmussen suggested, that this court only sends back issues that require factual development. This court routinely will say these issues should be addressed by the district court in the first instance, and these are the kinds of issues that should be.
We send it back when they're difficult, and at least the appellant has made an argument to show that it's difficult. There's been no effort by the appellants to show any flaw in the Indians' argument, and that makes it hard for me to see why that shouldn't be considered a waiver.
Well, we don't have the benefit. Let me say for sure that these issues are more difficult than they are being portrayed. They're also of considerable moment, right? Because it would be hard to suggest that. I don't think it would be fair to suggest that the tribes in the Tenth Circuit that possess trust lands necessarily view these issues as a monolith, right? I suspect that there are a wide range of, I think the record would show that there are a wide range of tribal views on this matter. And so our submission on this issue is really that it's one that needs further development in the district court. And we think that's consistent with cases like the Richardson case that we cite in our reply brief. On the SDWA issue, the suggestion here has been made here that one, that this is not a Chevron issue, and the reliance there has been placed on Brown and Williamson. And Brown and Williamson, as this court knows, is an extraordinary case. It is a case in which the Food and Drug Administration claimed authority over tobacco products. And the court could say there rather easily that there was no such authority. This case, as the court has explained, relates to authorities over federal lands that Congress has promulgated under its authority under the property clause to protect those lands. Plainly a Chevron issue, reasonable. One last thing. In terms of this particular regulation, of course it went through the rigorous interagency OIRA process. And EPA, in that process, completely agreed that these regulations were appropriate BLM regulations. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for all of your arguments and appearances this morning. The case is submitted. Court is in recess until 1:30.